Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a standard THC unit conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. A standard THC unit is being recommended like for alcohol. We have a standard unit of measurement for alcohol established by the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. A standard dose is 12 ounces for beer, 5 ounces for wine, and 1.5 ounces for shots. Using this standard unit definition, dietary guidelines on limits of alcohol were established. For the United States, those limits are no more than 14 standard drinks per week for men and 7 for women. At age 65, the standard goes down to 7 for both men and women. For some at-risk populations, that recommendation dose is 0, no alcohol. What should the standard unit be for THC? How many bowls, edibles, vapes are allowable or recommended? What about shatters and dabs? Are units for THC possible, like we have for alcohol and even tobacco? To learn more about the standard THC unit, I reach out to Dr. Tom Freeman. Professor Tom Freeman is a researcher in addiction psychology at the University of Bath in the UK. He directs the Addiction and Mental Health Group, an interdisciplinary group bridging psychology, life sciences, health management, and the Institute of Policy Research. His research has generated impacts with the National Institute of Health, the European Union, Drug Agency, and other influential healthcare institutions. Freeman is internationally known for his research on cannabis and cannabinoids. To learn more about Professor Tom Freeman, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Professor Freeman on May 8th, 2025. Professor Tom Freeman, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
It's great to have you here. And shout out and thank you to Dr. Marta DeForte, who connected us. She's done several podcasts with us. And she said that I got to talk to you. And I was asking her a whole bunch of questions about marijuana units and stuff. So that's great.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. And thanks to Marta for the shout out.
Yeah. And we hear that lovely accent. And to our non-UK audience, can you tell us a little bit about where you're from?
Thanks. I'm from the University of Bath, which is in southwest England. So I'm in the kind of close to London, but a little bit more green, a little bit more rain. It's where people who love the countryside live. We also have a lovely university and a beautiful bathing status, UNESCO World Heritage city called Bath that many tourists go to.
That's great. And so you're sitting there at the university academic center, and of all things in the world that you decided to study, you decided to study addiction and cannabis. Why is that?
You know, I think it's such a fascinating topic. So if you look around, there are so many people experiencing problems with drugs. When I was coming towards the end of my PhD, I was really interested in the kinds of changes we were seeing in this. It's something that you see in the communities amongst people. You know, you hear lots of problems about people using drugs, especially teenagers using cannabis. But around this time, finishing my PhD, I saw the European Union were collecting data on treatment for cannabis problems. And I was surprised to see that cannabis was the main reason people were seeking treatment for their addiction. And this to me came as a big surprise, because many of your listeners might have heard similar things to what I have, which is people say that cannabis is not addictive. These kinds of problems, they don't seem real. But actually, when you look at the treatment figures, this has been increasing over time, higher than for opioids. And to me, I was really interested to find out more about this. Why are people seeking treatment? What are the kinds of changes occurring? Something to do with cannabis products, are they changing? But also, how can we help people? how can we help people to reduce their harms? And also, how can we help to treat people who want to stop or cut down their use?
So the number one drug that people in the UK go to seek treatment for is cannabis. I don't think that's true in the United States. Is that just a local or European phenomenon?
This is across Europe. So we have a European Union agency. It's called EUDA. It's an agency for drug addiction. And since around 2012, cannabis has been the primary reason for first time clients coming into addiction treatment.
Interesting. And so now, as part of your, you know, academic position, you lead a group, the Addiction and Mental Health Group. What is that?
Good question. The Addiction and Mental Health Group is a large interdisciplinary research group. We have people from different departments in our university. So I'm based in psychology. I'm an addiction psychologist. We also have people working across the board. So we have pharmacists working with us. We have people working in the health sector. We have chemists who analyze drugs. We do a lot of work testing drugs on the illicit market. And we also have people looking at drug use from a sociological perspective. So it's really that wide range from synapse to society, really going from the neuroscience up into the more wider societal questions. And we're trying to, our overall mission is to eliminate the harms of drug use. We use research with robust methods, interdisciplinary teams to enhance the scope and the scale of what we can do, and then disseminating this to inform policy and practice.
That is fascinating. You got all the way from the lab and the chemistry to use and the brain. So your addiction psychologist, do you treat patients?
I don't work clinically. I do in the context of research, for example, working clinical trials to work therapeutically with people, but I don't work in a service.
Okay. So now let's get to something that really, you know, got Dr. DeForte to connect me to you when I was starting asking about units and standards. And she said, you are the expert. So the standard THC unit. So what is actually, before we get to the academic, what's a standard way that, like, for contemporary use of judging, like having one joint or four bowls or one edible? Like, that's kind of, is that the contemporary way of judging cannabis use, but not the academic way?
Well, this is a problem that's been brewing for decades. So my experience is my research has followed a path of experimental psychopharmacology, administering doses of THC and other cannabinoids in the lab, where we get people to come on visits where they receive either a certain dose of THC on one visit and then placebo, possibly with other drugs mixed in too, to look at interactions. Those really nice, precise controlled studies to look at specific doses of THC. But then moving to the real world, when we do longitudinal cohort studies and surveys, and we want to see what is the long-term impact of cannabis use on health. And this is a really important question, because lots and lots of people are using cannabis. There's a lot of discussion about potential benefits, potential risks. If we can't understand how much THC people are consuming, then we're really shooting in the dark. We've got no idea what that relationship is. And so I was kind of inspired by the work in the psychopharmacology studies, where we had really nice controlled data, we had a dosage, seeing if we could bridge that gap to the observational studies, collect those real world data. And also thinking about cannabis field is so diverse. It's something that's happened, especially in the States, where we have a rapid evolution of cannabis products. Some of the products you mentioned yourself, we have very different and a wide range of potencies now that we didn't used to have before. So measuring cannabis use in these surveys is very, very hard, because if, as a healthcare professional, you speak to an individual and you say, how much cannabis did you use? And they talk only about the flower that they consumed, but not the edibles or the concentrates or the topicals, et cetera. They're not really giving you the full picture. So the goal really was to generate a standard unit that could be used to measure all cannabis products and all methods of use. This indeed was something that the National Institute on Drug Abuse had been struggling with for decades, and they identified this as their number one research priority in their cannabis policy work group. So aligned with this, the idea that I had, together with an Australian researcher, Valentina Lorenzetti, was to develop a standard unit for THC. It was a single low dose of THC, 5 milligrams of THC for all products and methods of use. And then this is a way whereby using this unit, we can record any episode of cannabis use can be recorded in standard THC units. And that means if you're doing a research study, you can see how much THC overall did this person consume regardless of the method of use. And equally, in a healthcare setting, you can count units similar to the way that often healthcare professionals count standard drinks. So in the UK, if you go to a physician, one of the first things I'll say is, do you drink alcohol? And if so, how many alcohol units do you drink per week? We have limits of 14 units per week that are recommended that people don't exceed. And the idea here is, for cannabis, we can do the same thing. We count how much THC they're using. We can use this to then help them track their consumption and minimize their risk of harms.
So that sounds great in theory, right? We have that for standard drinks. We have it with tobacco. This person has a 20-pack year history. We have that for alcohol. But those products, that tobacco and alcohol, are fairly regulated, so we can make a standard. But when you go to a dispenser and you buy a product, you can't always count on what they're saying. And so can you explain a little bit more how it, let's start with blunts, you know, the most popular form of THC. How would you do that per unit? Because each blunt is not created equal, right? Some are fatter, skinnier, more concentrated flower, less concentrated flower.
Yeah, so it depends on the jurisdiction in which you are. So for example, if you are in a place where you can buy regulated products with labeling that gives a THC content, you can then have some information about how much cannabis you're consuming and the concentration of THC. And you can then use this to figure out, in the same way that, for example, an alcohol product would have the alcohol by volume on the label, certainly in the UK, the volume of the drink. And also we have the units. But even if you didn't, you can figure that out. We have online calculators that can help people. You just say which drinks you consume, how strong they were, and that will give you your units. It's the same idea for THC.
Interesting. So you're counting on the industry to kind of self-regulate or be honest in what they're putting on their label. So this is for the legal market, not for the illegal market. And so tell, like a joint with 10% THC, how many units would that be?
Well, it depends how much the joint weighed.
Uh-huh. What's an average weight?
You'd have to look. I mean, it could be, for example, half a gram.
Okay.
And you'd have to figure it out. I would say with the standard units,
yeah,
it is a precise measure. And I wouldn't want to say a joint contains this many units each time. You have to check in the same way as you do with alcohol units. And that's the important thing. You don't want to approximate so much that you're making generalizations.
But we do approximate. We've created that in alcohol, right? So in general, one beer, 12-ounce beers is one unit. You know, 5 ounces of wine, any wine is about that. So we're not like so perfect, but it gives people, you know, a guide.
Yeah.
So like a normal joint, is it more than 5 milligrams, more than one unit, or less?
Well, typically a joint. So a study in Spain that was done some time ago, they found that a typical joint contained 7 milligrams. And this was in the Spanish illicit market. I would say that a typical joint where you are probably contains quite a lot more than that. It just depends on how much a consumer adds to their joint and how much THC it contains.
Right.
But typically the idea is that the standard unit is lower than a typical method of consumption. And the idea here is, we know that smaller serving sizes encourage people to consume less. We see this for the alcohol field.
Interesting. So California market, we, for our legal dispensaries, the law was 10 milligrams per dose or 100 milligrams per chocolate. So like if you took a candy bar of chocolate, and I don't know if we have those in the UK, but one little cube of chocolate is 10 milligrams. And if you ate the whole thing, it would be 100 milligrams.
So 100 milligrams.
That'd be 200 units, right?
Yeah, 100 milligrams, that would be, 200, yeah.
Yeah, right. Because you're saying you're proposing a 5 milligram dose. So that's a lot. Like, how do you even make that legal?
Well, so if you look in US states and Canadian provinces, there's typically a limit of 5 or 10 milligrams per serving size. Yeah. And sometimes what we see is illicit vendors will sell products that are labeled up to 200, 400 milligrams. But actually, when you test those products, and we've seen these products in the UK because they also get sent here, they typically contain a lot less than that. So a properly regulated and well-labeled product typically isn't going to be containing that much. And these are why the regulations are there. The idea of the regulations around edibles are exactly the same as the idea of the standard unit, because we know, especially for edible products, it's very easy to overconsume with the time it takes for the onset to hit.
You may be interested in Oregon, the unit was for edibles was 5 milligrams. And then they wanted to be just like California and Washington. So they upped it to 10 milligrams and they were able to document the increased harms and poisonings because
of that. Yeah, that's right. I was saying that in Canada, there's a lot of interest in implementing this within the Canadian market. So it's a regulatory requirement. So that way the labels would include the units on there. And they're interested in going lower than 5 milligrams to 2.5 milligrams. So
nice.
Just to say that in the same way that alcohol units differ in different countries and having a lower size can be beneficial. This is something that differs in varying countries, and Canada is a really interesting place where this is being taken forward.
Well, that's interesting. Now, do you have the issues we have in as far as pediatric poisoning? Like the number one cause of children, babies to go to the emergency room from a poisoning is from cannabis. I don't, because of all those edibles mostly.
In the UK, this isn't such a large issue. We've just had, we just pre-printed a paper looking at edibles that have been seized in UK police forces. And most of the edibles were labeled with, what appear to be marketing saying that they can be sold in California, but actually they're illicit products. We do see some of these, a range of different sweets and condiments, lots of different products. They're not so common. The big issue for us in the UK is synthetic cannabinoids being sold, and typically these are in vapes. We found these in schools around England. So that's a big concern for us. We don't have as many people using edible products in our country. And I think it's something about the legal market that if these products are available, and especially if they are in products that are labeled to appeal to kids, then that's where the risk is. There's accidental or excessive consumption.
Yeah. Now, when you say synthetic cannabinoids, so we have two types that we consider synthetic. One is like the K2, the spice, and the other one is the hemp products. Now is a big problem now. The psychoactive hemp products like Delta 8 THC or Delta 10 THC. And I don't know if you mean both.
Yes, I know those. Yeah, so I would refer to the latter as semi-synthetics. Okay. But the former, so K2, spice, those are the ones we're talking about. So we were really puzzled by this because in the UK, and it might be the same way you are, these drugs were typically believed to be limited to the generally homeless and prison populations. And we did research in prisons and we found around half of the inmates using spice, which is what we expected. But what we were really surprised by was that we saw kids going to A&E around schools. And we've got a map of all of the places where this is happening all across the country. Like, well, it can't be THC because THC doesn't cause kids to have these severe adverse responses, typically, especially with the vape. And so when we did the testing, we found that this is vapes tested in routine practice from schools. They weren't suspected to contain drugs, but a sixth of those from the schools contained synthetic cannabinoids, the spice or K2 type. Only around 1% contained THC. And what it looks like is within this illicit market, kids believe they're buying THC in vapes, but it's actually cheaper to produce a synthetic cannabinoid vape and then to sell those illicitly to school kids.
That's terrible because those, some of them could be 100 times stronger binding to the cannabinoid receptors. The other thing is that as an emergency physician, the spices, the synthetic cannabinoids don't test in our drug screen. So we wouldn't know.
Yeah.
That they're using. So that's one of the kids like it because they can like evade detection if they're being drug tested. If you use these synthetic ones, nobody would know they're using. The only way we figure it out is if I have somebody coming in with a new onset seizure and I'm trying to figure out why they had a seizure. If I ask about that, that's the only way for me to find out. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's definitely an emerging problem in illicit markets. So you see a different situation where you are, I'm sure, compared to what we see.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking about you're trying to regulate a drug, like in the United States, it's still federally illegal, but we're still trying to get, the industry to put fair labels. I'm wondering if it's not if that's the case in UK, where you really it's legalized, and so you're able to work with an industry, and if they're able to go beyond the units, but also contaminants, you know, so with tobacco, we gave up. We just put labels. This has carcinogens. They can give you cancer, and that's that. With alcohol, you know, way back before our time, bootleg alcohol could have methanol, was causing blindness. We kind of fixed that around the world with that, with a very regulated alcohol industry. But now with the cannabis industry, besides not knowing what units you're using, they also have heavy metals, E. coli, fungus, other things like that that we fixed in the alcohol industry. And I'm wondering if that's even talked about.
Yeah, it's definitely something that people talk about. Certainly finding samples with mold in, when you have samples that have been left for a long time, samples with high levels of moisture, that's something that's been reported. There have been some cases, for example, in Wales, close to where I am, samples with things that make a product look more potent or more costly than it is. So, for example, having glass beads put around cannabis flowers to make it look like trichomes containing THC. These are the kinds of things we see, certainly within cannabidiol products, which have been tested and again extracted from the cannabis plant. We see often high levels of heavy metals. So I do think it's a big concern, and it's always going to be a risk when you don't have a product that's properly regulated.
Yeah. So you talk about harm reduction when it comes to cannabis. And do you have a definition? I think in the United States, we don't have a common definition of what harm reduction really even means. Some people want it to reduce harms from somebody who's not ready to quit, and others have taken it to social justice and, and equity.
Yeah, okay. So just to put it into context, when we think about drug harms, there are three main ways that we might act. So one would be prevention, to prevent an individual from ever trying a drug for the first time. We have these universal programs often offered in schools, which if effective, that solves the problem from the beginning. But of course, many people do try drugs. And for those, some will use occasionally and not have problems. Others will develop a problematic pattern of use and might develop a cannabis use disorder. And for those, the mainstay option would be treatment. And so if that individual was interested in quitting use completely or reducing their use, then we would work with them towards those goals. Now, treatment typically focuses on abstinence as an endpoint, although there is a lot of interest now, and Laura Volkov wrote a blog on this for the National Institute on Drug Abuse about having not just abstinence as an endpoint, but a reduction in use. And I think it's an interesting thing. If you talk to people who use drugs, and this goes for alcohol and cannabis as well, some people want to stop completely, whereas others just want to get their life back. So it's a case of there can be a meaningful change in reducing drug use. It doesn't mean you have to quit completely. And this obviously, it just depends on the individual and what it means to them. A harm reduction
can that must be controversial, right? Because if you're a smoker, we want you to quit smoking. I mean, of course, in order to quit, you have to reduce. But the end goal is to not smoke.
Yeah, and so harm reduction kind of sits in that middle ground. So harm reduction would say that, yes, one way to reduce the harms, in fact, to eliminate completely is to stop. But for some people who are unable or unwilling to do that, they might either reduce the amount of the drug they use, or indeed there might be other methods. So, for example, with cannabis, one of the main risks involved is co-administration with tobacco. So it might be that for some individuals, they would see the key thing they want to change is to stop using tobacco at the same time as cannabis, given the increased risks of tobacco use compared to cannabis. And of course, the best advice is you should be abstinent from both of these drugs. Dual abstinence is the best outcome, but you have to work with people according to their goals. And if you give them a goal they can't achieve, perhaps you risk alienating them and missing the opportunity.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, historically, with people who have alcohol use disorder, tobacco addiction, the goal is not you cut down maybe, but the goal is not, you know, to protect your health. And if you get room, then you've kind of lowered the goalpost of where you want people to be. So, but it's an interesting debate. I want to make sure we talk about treatment for cannabis use disorder, because you're doing research on that. So fill us in on that.
Thanks. So I mentioned earlier that we can look at prevention, harm reduction, and treatment. And I also mentioned earlier that the rates of treatment for cannabis use disorder have been increasing in Europe, and it's now the primary reason for people coming forward to addiction services. So with this in mind, we were interested in developing pharmacotherapies, because if you go to a healthcare professional now with a cannabis use disorder, they can only offer you talking therapies. There's no approved medication that can help people come off. And when we think about tobacco, for example, we know that there are lots of medications people can use that help them to quit. It helps with their withdrawal symptoms. It helps them to remain abstinent. And this is really critical. We don't have that for cannabis yet. So the idea was to test cannabidiol or CBD for lots of reasons. One being the very good safety data of CBD, because we know that side effects are a big concern, and CBD has a really good safety and tolerability profile. But also we've done a lot of research comparing the effects of THC when combined with CBD and without the psychopharmacology studies I mentioned earlier. And we were very interested in how CBD could be a potential treatment based on some mechanisms it might work to help people remain abstinent. So what we did is, given that this was a novel study indication, we didn't have any ideas about which doses might be best in terms of efficacy or safety. We chose an adaptive design. And this means you start with essentially a range of different doses, almost like you can consider them horses in a race. I mean, you don't know which one's going to win, but you set them all off and then you test which one's getting ahead. And any which don't look promising, you then just cut them off. And then you start allocating your resources to those additional doses or horses which do look promising. So we started off with placebo, really important to have a good control group. We then had 200 milligrams, 400 milligrams, and 800 milligrams of CBD. And those were our potential doses. In the anxiety literature for cannabidiol, it looks like there's an inverted U dose response curve. And this means that you have to get the dose just right. If it's too low or too high, it won't be the right one. And that was why we had this wide dose range. So we did the study, we started randomizing people to these four groups, and we found at an early stage that the 200 milligram group, the lowest dose, was not going to be an efficacious treatment for cannabis use disorder. So we stopped that, cut that arm from the trial, kept on recruiting people to placebo, 400 and 800. And once we'd finished a trial with those three groups, we found that both 400 and 800 milligrams were more efficacious than placebo. So this was a reduction in cannabis use, both according to urinary measures and to self-report, which is really exciting because it was the first trial ever to test cannabidiol as a treatment for cannabis use disorder. And quite interesting, almost paradoxical, that the cannabis plant might contain a medication to help people come off the drug itself, which we thought was very exciting. And the people we spoke to were really, really keen to be using cannabidiol. They saw it as potentially quite a promising treatment for them and one they would want to take, especially given the lack of side effects when compared to other psychiatric medications. But this trial that we did, the one we've published, is an initial study. It's a small phase two trial showing proof of concept and dose finding. So at the moment, we're testing this in a large multi-site trial in Australia, of which we're almost finished recruitment. And this is going to give much more definitive evidence about the potential role of cannabidiol as a treatment for cannabis use disorder.
Is that being used anywhere? Like it would be Epidiolex to treat cannabis use disorder?
Well, it's being used in clinical trials. It's not recommended because we don't have the strong enough evidence. I can tell you we have these positive results from phase two. But what I say is it's when we write clinical guidelines for cannabis use disorder, it's just too early to recommend this. So I would say in terms of risk benefit, there's not going to be any risks in prescribing cannabidiol for cannabis use disorder. But we just don't know if the benefits are going to be there yet. So it's not something we currently recommend.
I read one study that there was an 80% relapse for people using it within 1 or 6 months. I did a different podcast with Ginger Constantine from Pleo Pharma, and they are also doing trials. They're using a partial cannabinoid receptor agonist and another drug. And when I asked her, if cannabidiol works by itself, and she said no. So it's interesting how this is why science and experiments are important, because you're getting different answers to the same question. So we'll have to.
Yeah, Yeah, I think it's really important to do the research and not to overstate the findings. So as I said, we did this phase two trial. We published the results. We had the efficacy in the endpoints that we wanted, but it was an early stage trial. So whilst a very optimistic view could say, yes, we should prescribe this, my view is that we shouldn't, and we need to do more research. And a definitive phase three trial is coming out. So that's what we need to look for. And in fact, to take more of a pessimistic view, when we look historically at medications for cannabis use disorder, we still don't have any. As I said, we've had lots of potential pharmacotherapies that have looked positive at phase two, but they don't make it at phase three. And I can't say if that's going to happen for cannabidiol or not, but it is the thing that's happened to all of the other medications. So it's a holy grail. And is cannabidiol going to be the one? We just don't know yet. It could be something else. It could be cannabidiol. Maybe we'll never find it.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait and see.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, testing products of different places. And I think I read in your research that you also have a device that detects synthetic cannabinoids. I thought about it's kind of like fentanyl strips. So people are buying things and they want to know. And now here you could know what you're buying. Is that kind of the thought? Is the device available to law enforcement or to the public or both?
Yeah, so this is related to the work I mentioned where we found vapes in schools containing synthetic cannabinoids.
Yeah.
So this was a device developed at the University of Bath with the idea that in the context when you have illicit drugs, you don't have a nationwide drug testing facility. It's really important for people to have access, especially in the case of these new novel drugs. So synthetic cannabinoids being very, very risky and related to around half of non-natural deaths in prisons in the UK, so a real killer. And at the same time, synthetic opioids, what we have over in the UK is nitazenes being the recent problem. And I know you have problems with opioids in the States as well. So the idea here is that the handheld device can give you instant results. And the other thing is that it can be tested in a range of different matrices. So for example, in the case of prisons where we see lots of spice being smuggled in, one of the ways in which this is done is through a loophole, because people know that the prison staff cannot open a parcel if it's a legal document because it has to be protected. And so what they do is then they impregnate the spice on the paper. And then this is a way to bring it in. So what the device can do is it can just scan some paper and it will tell you, is there the presence of synthetic cannabinoids or spice here? And if so, yes. And then that can then be detected and stopped from entering the prison. At the same time, it can be used for other kinds of matrices, all kinds of things that might get into prisons, but also testing of vapes, drug samples. We also used it for the edible products we found, which we believe came from North America.
Is this specific for the synthetic cannabinoids or other drugs? Is it kind of like a pregnancy test, positive or negative?
No. So it's based on a spectral fingerprinting technique, which it shines a light, a fluorescence approach. It develops distinctive patterns for different drugs, and it's based on a library and a deep learning technique. And this means it can be tuned to different drugs in the library. The main ones it's good at are synthetic cannabinoids and synthetic opioids, but in theory, it can be trained to others as well.
So this is just for law enforcement?
Well, we developed it at the university. It's been designed for a range of different settings. So one, for example, is in schools. Another could be in prisons. The police have a big interest in this. We thought it could potentially be useful for healthcare services. So, for example, if somebody presents to an emergency psychiatric facility because of psychotic symptoms, we don't know, have they consumed a synthetic cannabinoid or indeed THC? We could get that instant result. Perhaps there's less interest with the healthcare services than there are in law enforcement, but the idea is that it could be used in a range of settings.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in the hospital, we cannot test for synthetic cannabinoids. We cannot test for nitazenes. So we would, you know, you could easily have someone with an opioid overdose and our drug test would be negative, or somebody who is having a seizure from a synthetic cannabinoid and their drug screen would be negative because we don't have that capability on an immediate basis. So that's interesting. And also very scary that you have nitazenes. We have that in the United States, but it's not big. And nitazenes, for our listeners, are much more potent than even fentanyl. So it's pretty scary that you have that.
Oh no, we're terrified by it. It's really concerning, especially seeing what's happened in the US. That hasn't happened so badly for us now, but we do have nicotines coming in, so it's the next wave of the opioid epidemic. And we've recently done some study of heroin use in the UK, and we're detecting nitazenes in the UK in heroin samples, again using this device. So we're really, really worried, and we hope we can look to you for guidance of how to manage this. But drug testing is one of the really important things that we hope we can do to help people reduce their risk of overdose.
That's interesting, because the drug testing for nitazenes that we have now is only the medical examiner's office when things are too late, or the sheriff department. We don't have, but luckily for us, the nitazenes are always with another opioid. So as a medical provider, you would test positive for a different opiate, not nitazene, that, you know, and then the treatment would be the same.
Okay. Yeah, what we've seen is all kinds of combinations, I have to say.
Yeah, that is very scary.
Yeah.
I saw one article you wrote about stigma. Stigma is huge. Oh, yeah. People always talk about stigma, stigma, stigma. Stigma kills. We don't want stigma. But I think it's gone a little too far, because it's if you destigmatize drug use, then you kind of allow drug use. We don't want stigma on the human being who has a condition, a medical problem that should have compassionate care. But again, using the tobacco analogy, we don't want tobacco. We don't want people to smoke. If you're a smoker, we're not going to hate you for it, but it's a problem and you'd want to go do it in a corner away from other people. Now, tell us
I'm not sure if I would agree. I'm not sure stigma is a good thing. I think, and it goes back to the idea of harm reduction and personal choice. Say, if you can give people the information they need, the support, the interventions to make their decisions, then they can act in their best interests, and we can help to do this for the public good. But if we stigmatize people to the extent that they're marginalized, that they lack the confidence to go forward to seek help, they're more likely to hurt themselves and even die. And this is, I mean, the heroin and nicotine drug testing is a really good point here, because if heroin use wasn't so stigmatized, people would be much more able and willing to come and discuss this with a healthcare professional to seek treatment, to have their drugs tested. We would engage them in a much more meaningful conversation, and the risk of them having these adverse events would be much, much less. The stigma makes the problem worse. And so I don't think that stigma is a good thing.
But what you were mentioning, something about inconsistencies in the media campaigns of stigma, and I wanted to understand that better.
Well, I guess when you look at the media and the way that the media reports drugs, what you see is that there's a very distinct pattern whereby illicit drug use is reported almost every time there's a problem with illicit drugs that's reported. Particularly well characterized for ecstasy related deaths. So in the press, certainly in the UK, any ecstasy related death would consistently be reported, whereas for alcohol or tobacco, it just wouldn't be. And so you have this idea that the press is giving a more biased and unbalanced view of particular health behaviors, especially when they relate to illicit drug use. And then this changes perceptions about people's understanding of safety. And that makes it harder then to reach people with a really clear evidence-based information.
Yeah. I guess, you know, let's take something that's not drugs, obesity, yeah. Right? You know, if you're overweight, you should be told you're overweight, you should lose weight. It's not, I'm not going to treat you. We're not going to stigmatize or body shame you, but you should know that, you know, you're,
yeah, absolutely.
That's not your ideal weight. That's not where we want you to be. We want you to get to a better weight. And I guess, you know, the same thing for drugs, like you're using drugs. This is not healthy. Okay. This is not where we want you to be. We think better for you. So again, stigma on the drug, but not on the person. Same thing.
I would say that stigma is not a good thing in any circumstance. I would say give the person the health information, but don't stigmatize them. It's essentially, here's some information about healthy eating, but I'm not going to fat shame you.
Interesting.
You see what I mean? It's different. Yeah.
All right. So you're about to get off this call and go hang out with your children. What is your advice for your kids?
Stay safe. And keep talking. Open up those communication lines. Don't shut down, and look after your friends.
Are you going to tell them don't use drugs or?
Well, I'll let them make their own minds up.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Tom Freeman, for this conversation. And good luck with your research. Pretty incredible. I think I counted 13 publications this year for you, and the year's not even halfway over. So it's incredible amount of work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, and a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the interview. Really interesting.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, that's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.